From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of The Groundsman. Joining me out here in the middle, as always, leaning on their rakes, are my two lazy co-conspirators, Roger Mitchell and Giles Morgan. Giles, let's bring you in first. How are you, mate?
I'm good. It's autumnal here in Wandsworth. I've been sweeping leaves and looking after the ship's dogs, Bruce, who has been causing havoc. So I need new rakes, new brushes, and probably new tyres to the mower. So I may be fairly useless this week, but we'll give it a shot.
I think you're also mixing your metaphors there with rakes and ship's dogs. Confusion setting in left and right. Well, to clear that up, how about we bring in the third musketeer, Roger Mitchell?
Hi there. Hi. Just before we met today, I did manage to get a quick 18 in early in the morning. So I'm particularly full of myself today. It was there was nobody on the course. I just thought we'd try and get a round in just in case they locked everything down here again and we couldn't get on the course. Nobody there. And of course, when nobody's there, you swing it like Seve, don't you? It was beautiful. It was a beautiful thing.
But conveniently, no witnesses, Roger.
No witnesses. Just as well.
No witnesses.
I mean, if I did that in a medal, I think they would have been coming for you, Grant.
Listen, it's coming for me. I've got nothing to do with this. I've got absolutely nothing to do with this, Rog. And I will, if anyone comes at me, I will send them straight back to you. If you had any decency and honour, you would actually walk the plank yourself, my friend.
Well, it's interesting. You've got your golf bug back, Rog. And I, for many years, was probably the most over-promoted golfer on the planet. And as you know, well known for being the worst golfer on the professional circuit by the pros. I've retired from golf. That's it. I'm done. I've hung up my clubs, if you can.
Is that right?
That. Yeah. So inept. And also, in the days when I used to be important in the game of golf, people tolerated it. Now people don't.
Are you going to open a garden centre with all the turf you've dug out the grooves before you put them on eBay?
No, actually, what I should be doing is just going around all the courses I've ever played and pick up the golf balls. I would be rich.
Well, I dare say they're not there anymore. I'm not there because the dogs would have had them by now.
Yeah,
well,
true.
Gentlemen, as always, seems like there's plenty to discuss this week. Plenty to discuss, particularly some of these big themes that we on this podcast have been hammering on about now for quite some time. Giles, I know some stuff's caught your eye this week. What's got you energised?
Well, I think everything's getting all of us energised all of the time because every morning you open a newspaper or an industry magazine and there's something going on, whether it be Premier League, which you guys obviously spoke about at length on Goal and Goal and still will rumble on, I suspect, for months. You've got a lot of news coming out about reduction and viewership numbers across the board in both North America and around the world and sports coming right down. You've got corporations, also known as sponsors, who are making massive redundancies and so on in terms of their own businesses and cutting costs accordingly because of COVID. And with lack of spectators in many, many sporting arenas, ticketing numbers are down, which paints the bleakest picture where three of the four revenue streams, if you take merchandise and online, may be out of it, significantly down and paints a very gloomy picture. And yet, we all know that the world will start spinning again. What I think about a lot, and I know we've been discussing this offline, is how the world starts to spin again will look different, but also great events in history and great circumstances, which COVID has been, often have a very, very significant after effect that couldn't have been predicted before. And that's what seems to be happening within the sports industry, which I'd love to use as a kind of general theme for today, is the future that we paint today may not be the future that we thought it would have been a year ago. Even if COVID was simply an acceleration of the inevitable, or whether it has changed people's habits and consumption in a way that you couldn't have dreamt possible, I think the two come into play and will make for a very different looking industry going forward, which we have been talking about for a while. But still, when I read the paper, still when I read sort of fanzines and people going on, there is a clamour just to go back how it was before. And it feels a bit like, you know, the pre-industrial revolution and the post-industrial revolution saying, no, those steam machines, they'll never work. They'll never work. They'll never do the job that people could do by hand. And of course, it changed everything. So that's what's catching my eye. I kind of in a historical way, we know we're living through history, but it's, as always with history, it's the consequences of events that is really what is most interesting right now in the sports industry.
Yeah, I think that's spot on, Giles. I think that's beautifully put. COVID is going to change everything. You know, like I've been looking at, you know, the day job type stuff, and, you know, people are not going back into offices. It's going to change everything. I was looking at the weekend about, you know, what the plans for Zoom are and their new products and their new ways of meeting people and doing things automatically together. People aren't going back into offices. People are leaving the cities and going back to rural communities. This is an epical change. But I would say this to add on to what you were saying. I probably started, you know, writing about the sports industry a couple of years ago and thought I could, you know, maybe share my views with people. And then obviously this little podcast came along and I was joined with a couple of splendid fellows to continue that. But what made me start this 2 years ago was, in my opinion, seeing my children, my teenage children, telling me about how they consumed content. Let's use that word, content. And that continues to inform me. You know, I was the weekend, another couple of examples. You know, my son's currently in London in a hall of residence for university. And, you know, we're chatting about the games and he watches the games in the common room. And I said, are there a lot of football fans there? He says, well, they say they are, Dad. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, they say they're Arsenal fans and Tottenham fans, but they can't name the lineup. They can't get past a couple of players. They're not really fans. They're superficial. And, you know, they check out of the game. And I said, you're just the same. He says, yeah, okay, but... And I thought, you're just the same. And then I spoke to my daughter, who's 2 years younger. She's 16. And I said, what's it like in your peer group in school, the boys especially? Are they into sport? Is sport a thing? Now, he said, Dad, not really. You know, it's not really a thing anymore. Even the boys, you know, like they'll have a couple of, like, slag-offs at the Inter Milan derby. And then, you know, they run out of energy very, very quickly and they're not going to continue. And I said, well, what do your generation consume? Well, we know the answer to that. But, you know, it just gets reinforced all the time. They do Netflix series. They talk about that. That's the water cooler moments. So what I'm thinking, to add on to your point, Giles, is I honestly believe that it was coming anyway, but coming huge, and COVID is not going to allow us in any way to try and get back to where we were. And like you, I'd like to think that today and over the next few episodes of The Groundsman, we can talk about those ripple effects that are going to become tsunamis for sport and the content industries in the next 18 months. I think 2021 is going to be much harder than 2020. So I think you've nailed the theme, Captain. We're no longer in Kansas, if I can use that phrase.
Gents, let me ask you both. I've watched the second Bledisloe Cup, and again, I made this point last week with Rog. The difference in the experience, even sitting at home watching it on TV, in having a big, passionate crowd there, it really hits you hard. You realise, I mean, I kind of conceptually realised how much I missed having the fans in the background, but having been, you know, fanless for the best part of a year now, to see that, it changes it completely for me. So, you know, how do you think the two of you, sports will and needs to adapt if, let's say, there are no fans allowed back in you know, Northern Hemisphere, Western Hemisphere, whichever way you want to go with it, stadiums for another year? How does sport adapt to survive that problem?
I'll have a go, and I know Rog will definitely have a view on this. I really agree, and I wasn't sure, you know, the binary nature of competition, does it matter whether there's an audience or not? And I listened to your excellent Goal on Goal, and you talked about the Bledisloe during that particular show. And I decided that I was going to watch, I think, what is arguably one of the greatest individual sporting moments in history, he says with some hyperbole, but Franz Klammer skiing down the Hahnenkamm in 1976. Yeah. Obviously on just about on one ski most of the time, but he took downhill skiing to its ever greatest edge. No, well, probably pun intended as well. There's Bruce the dog having a bark. And I realized as I watched this piece of very old television footage where there's Klammer going down there doing the impossible, that actually it was because of not just the pistes surrounded by some very, very excited Austrians, obviously, but it was the noise and the noise
the
of
bells,
the bells
yeah.
and the chills. Yeah. Yeah. And it's the whole thing. And I realized, and I've talked about this a bit on the captain's table with some of the guests, is that home advantage statistically it doesn't matter what it used to before, but also just the theatre of sport, the emotion sport, the very passion of sport that we all buy into, which is why people become fans in the first place, that's been cut. And therefore, if we can't get fans back in, having the odd bit of plastic sort of noise to come in on a football match, which is piped noise, may be one form of technology. But if fans can't come in, it's going to have to be superimposed. And that's obviously something that Smart Sports talked about way back when. But we need to see audience as part of the experience and hear it. And of course, noise can be generated in real time. It can be done through very clever electronic means. But that's the answer to your question, is sport played in empty arenas, it's like theatre with no one in it. It's still the actors acting, but you're not feeding, and you're not feeding from the collective of humanity. And I think that media will want and demand some form of audience in terms of their visualization. Sponsors will, because if the product doesn't look good, if you don't have people there, it doesn't look very good, and it doesn't look very attractive because people are attracted in. And I think it's going to be a real area now. If people for the next 2 years are not really going to be attending matches and events, and maybe for the next 10 years, maybe for 50 years, it's just going to look very, very different because of environmental pressures, etc. There are other reasons why attendance may be harder and harder. Then the whole staging of sport that creates that sense of occasion needs to be focused on, because if you just rely just on the field of play, something is missing. It doesn't mean the skills are there. The Bledisloe Cup, the European Cup this weekend with Exeter, one of the greatest pieces of refereeing decisions in history, by the way, by a great Welshman, Nigel Owens, but we can talk about that later as
well. Yeah, please do. I'd love to hear that.
You still need fans involved. And I know that sounds obvious, but it's the bit that's missing.
Well, I'm going to answer the question round the houses a little bit, Grant, because do you know what my thing is? I'm getting really fed up with this collective noun, sport. I think sport as a homogeneous descriptor is redundant now. I think, Grant, what you have is a collection of passionate communities that are separated by demographics, by age, by sex. And to answer your question, sport needs in the very first instance to stop talking with the collective noun. It needs to start talking about the middle-aged white guy that loves golf in the way that we all three do, the kids that enjoy football in a more superficial way, like I described 10 minutes ago, the massively underserved female audience and what kind of delivery they want. I think sport is entering into the world and the era of strategic marketing. I mean serious strategic marketing. I don't mean the nonsense that gets talked about to sound good. I'm talking about segmenting audiences, matching those audiences with content that is seen to be appropriate to them, and through a distribution mechanism to where they want to consume it. Sport is no longer a collective noun. We have to think about these different audiences, as I've just described. And then I think, coming back to Giles's point, we need to address what is the issue that you raised, Grant, which is the one about fans. Now, Giles is right. You know, the fans are needed for the media product. The good news is that that can be replicated with tech. Necessity is the mother of invention. Giles mentioned smart sports. You know, the idea, and we've seen it in the movie industry, that the idea that you take actors and they're no longer in a theatre with humans, but you put them in a studio that's green screen, and then they come out with the Avengers franchise. That sport absolutely has to go in that direction, and it's probably right to go in that direction because that whole Fortnite world is what the younger demographics want. So I think that the move to get past the, you know, the fake crowd and the video screens and just go the whole hog and just say, we're going to play this game of football in the jungle in Kuala Lumpur and this will look super cool. I think that's the future, Grant.
I would actually completely agree with what you've just said then, in terms of if you take the movie industry as where it was theatre, that was acting, and then the movies were invented. And then you looked at special effects. And I remember when Superman came out in the 70s, and it was the first sort of time, you know, there was the late Christopher Reeve being suspended by invisible wires-ish. And then guess what? You'd fast forward now, the films and what's being made, like the Marvel series, it's astonishing, and people flock in and there are a million offsets. The great thing about sport is it still requires huge amounts of skill, dexterity, all the things, physicality that sport has. But given that we're in this moment now, perhaps for many years, where attendance is going to be either tricky or prohibited, if that's what COVID delivers, or people are nervous of attending, or people just don't want to attend because there are other distractions. Well, how do you create that theatre? You create the theatre through technology. And cinema has already paved the way. The movie industry has paved the way. It doesn't mean that live sport and real spectators can't coexist. You can still go to the theatre and see a sellout. Well, you used to be able to. Hopefully you'll be able to go again. But sport positioning itself, and something I said earlier to you guys, which I feel really, I'm borrowing this mercilessly from various authors who I'm fans of, which is one of the things about sport is it doesn't really matter. That we create the myth around sport, which is about it matters because of the passion of the fans, but it's all made up. It's human construct. It's not different from religion.
Could I take you to Glasgow this morning and you see if that holds?
Well, only, what I mean is the myth matters.
Half of Glasgow, Rog.
Yeah.
Either half, it matters to everybody, one way or the other.
What I'm saying is, I'm not saying it doesn't matter. What I'm saying is we create the myth that it matters. And what COVID has done by playing in front of empty stadia, and it's shown it in real stark relief that it's, if without the myth and without the tinsel and without the baubles, but most importantly, without the belief, it suddenly looks quite, if you look at it philosophically, it looks quite scant. And therefore, what sport needs to do is to rebuild the myth in a sense that humans get behind it and to get that passion. And that's my feeling, which means, of course, the passion's there because people choose to believe. But if you give reasons, it's just like the Christian church over the last 100 years. There are less and less reasons to believe, and there's been an enormous drop off in attendance. Guess what? Until this year. And suddenly the need state has grown and even people can't go to church. People are talking about faith. Well, in a sense, what COVID has done is wobbled the faith of sport. And therefore, oh my God, why am I going down a religious theme? I'll probably get excommunicated, but we'll keep going. The bishops, the archbishops and all of the clergy now need to get to there and say, how are we going to rewrite this in a way that people can believe? And that's about the magic of it, and that can be enhanced, and these are these seismic moments which are why we're living through such an astonishing time, because you couldn't have predicted this. Well, Bill Gates did, but not many others did.
Let me play devil's advocate here if we're continuing the religious theme, Giles. First of all, obviously, as a Fulham fan, I know an awful lot about faith, so I can talk to you about that all day long. But this, you know, Roger, you talk about this, you know, green screen backgrounds and playing the game in the jungle, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, that would be cool for about 5 minutes, and it would capture, I think, the crowd that we've debated back and forth for the entire lifespan of this project of ours, and that is, do you want to spend all your time trying to engage the casual fan with a short attention span, or do you want to play to your
You have to do them all.
No, I understand that, but let me finish. Once you do that, you create these surreal worlds that will be to hardcore fans of Liverpool Everton, let's say, right, who can't go to the game. Do they really want to watch it being played in Machu Picchu? No, it's gimmicky, and it's not about gimmicks. It's all about the football to the fans. And so you need the television experience to be something engaging and that will secure a captive audience, because without that, the TV companies will walk away and take their sponsorship money with them. But how do you engage through TV trickery with hardcore fans to whom it's all about the game? Because what I've realized watching the Bledisloe the last 2 weeks is that the fans there are passionate about one thing and one thing only, the rugby, and within that segment, their team, passionate about it. Do you think many of them give a toss what it would look like on TV? No, they're at the game because they don't want to watch it on TV. They want to be there. They want to experience the buzz. And so when I'm watching it on TV, you feed off that. You feed off the cutaway shots to the crowd when there's been a big play, and you see guys with looks of complete astonishment on their face, hugging each other and jumping up and down. You absolutely feed off that. And so when you take that away and you replace it with something that is fake, I get it. You're trying to create a different atmosphere, but I think the atmosphere you are going to try and create is going to be completely. It's going to be received completely differently by the hardcore fans who make the difference in terms of atmosphere and the casual fan who may be engaged with it for a moment in time.
Well, for instance, I think we've mentioned before, there are a number of data companies or technology companies out there at the moment, one in Canada called Hear Me Cheer, which is what I would have is a rendered environment of big fans with, you know, huge. So I wouldn't do Machu Picchu particularly. I would do a massive stadium, absolutely packed to the rafters. But the way the cheering works is that fans on their mobile phone devices are asked to press the button for cheering. And the amount of volume that generates in real time creates noise. And the more that fans are engaging, the more the noise.
It's personalised, Grant.
It becomes personalised content.
It's tailored to you. So if you want to enjoy West Ham against Fulham, and the choice is...
Right, you never enjoy West Ham against Fulham.
Well, you don't, because you always lose. But the point is, we will get to the stage that you will have the choice at one point to even fucking watch it in the old Upton Park, right? You know, the technology will give you, it's like the Star Trek, what do you call it, holodeck, you know? That is the future. And especially if we can't get back into stadia, tech will solve this. I'm a great believer that the tech has always sorted out the problems of humanity. And that comes back to my point. It's not sport anymore. It's what do I need to do for Grant Williams, who doesn't want to see a Fortnite-type game played in a space station. He wants to go back to, you know, the nostalgia days and feel it really real and smell and taste the Bovril. Tech will solve that. My point is that that's clear to me about where it's going to go and how it's going to be segmented and the choices, as Giles says, that you will get. The other thing that I think tech will solve is the kind of watch party, what I call empowering the micro passionate communities of fans. You know, companies like Livelike, like Entourage Media, ones that take what is a very clear population of what I call super fans and allow them to really, you know, bump off each other and, you know, get that kind of like energy that you're talking about. That will be much more enhanced in the coming years. So there's good news. There's good news all around where I think COVID will push us to go into what we needed to get into and stop talking about sport as a collective noun. It's no longer. It's a collective of micro content experiences that appeal to different people. The problem is that sport has worked on the principle of trickle-down economics. The big clubs and the big rights holders have subsidised Scunthorpe versus Aldershot. So the question, in my humble opinion, to ask is what is the future for Scunthorpe versus Aldershot? Because they ain't going to be rich enough to pay for a rendered game or some of the tech that we've talked about. And the discussion just now around the EFL and subsidies and who's paying for this and what in the pyramid system, that's where we are today. You know, and all the three of us have got the luxury of not having to be responsible for a major rights holder just now. You saw that the chief executive of the EFL packed it in. I don't blame him. But, you know, the point is this. When the cord cutting comes, when the subscriptions drop like ESPNs are falling through the floor, when you've got all these fragmented audiences and you no longer have got a model that allows for trickle-down economics, what you going to do? You just going to let them go to the wall a la Thatcherism, or are you going to come up with a new deal? That for me is the macro mega big picture.
And I've got a question for both of you, actually, in terms of, as you talk about the Thatcher approach would have been, you know, let the survival of the fattest, I guess, would probably be the best way of doing it and let them thrive. What do you feel, both? I'm going to send it back on you, particularly with your mutual love of football, is even if sport or the clubs are bailed out in the short term, what happens in the medium term? Is this a never-ending abyss of money? Or does this need to be the change, particularly if TV, if viewership is down? What does happen from an economic point of view, other than complete Armageddon? Because I see both sides of the argument. I think, Graham, what you were talking about in the last show was about governments just simply cannot bail out football like this. It would be never ending and the taxpayer, quite rightly in my view, wouldn't have it. So what does happen? How does this play out? That's a big question, but I'm interested.
Well, I think you're right. We touched on this in the last goal on goal. And, you know, it's okay to print money and bail out, quote unquote, the economy, because everyone's a fan of the same team at that point, right? I mean, everyone is a fan of the economy, and so you're not arguing against competing desires to have that money funneled towards them. But as soon as you get into the world of any kind of sport, football being particularly polarizing, you've got no chance at all. So, yeah, I think what they will try and do is secure whatever money they can, but it will be on the basis that, well, hopefully this will see us through to this renaissance, resurgence, whatever you want to call it, somewhere down the line. And we need to bring that forward as fast and as far as we can. But it seems to me, and Rog has a much better insight into this than I do, but it seems to me that the damage is already so big that these clubs are on borrowed time as it is. And, you know, the difference between stimulus and maintenance payments is important here. You know, stimulus is put into this thing to try and kickstart things. But when you've got clubs and sports and national associations coming to you that need money just to stay in business, that's a whole different thing. And so, I think one of the very first podcasts we did at the beginning of the COVID era was about this. Roger's numbers at the time seemed apocalyptic to many, but as usual in these matters, he's been absolutely spot on. So I'm curious to think whether your opinion has changed, Roger, or your stance has actually perhaps got bleaker. I don't know. Do you see a swifter end to this, or do you think this is going to drag on for much longer?
This is how I see it, and how I always address difficulties in life and business. You've got a current situation of crisis. So you project forward and you say, when the crisis passes, does this company, football club, business, whatever term you want to call it, and they're all of them, does it have a future? Does it have a sustainable economic future? So let's say we're past COVID. Does Aldershot and Scunthorpe have a future? My view is it does, because I've always said that the release pressure valve is the players' wages. So if you're just getting a lot less money, you just pay players less, and if you're disciplined, you can have a nice community club, a passionate community, as I said, a fragmented, passionate community of that sport demographic, and you can have a go at it. So I believe that post-COVID, you can have a sustainable sports business. And that means, how do you get through the current crisis? Because there's no point in getting through the current crisis if there's no future at the end. If I'm saying I think there is a future, then getting through the current crisis is about some people paying more than that. It's a little bit like the EU grant, at the end of the day, it always comes back, are the German taxpayers prepared to bail it out? It's a little bit the same in football. Are the Premiership big six clubs prepared to bail them out? And the answer is probably going to be yes. You're getting them blackmailed by the government now. You're getting everybody coming on their case. The thing that I think is the risk here is that this, what I will call crisis-led need for trickle-down economic socialism, whatever you want to call it, I think it would be wrong if that then becomes the status quo going forward. I desperately believe that sport needs to embrace the polarization and set itself up for a world of Hollywood clubs and community clubs. If they use this moment to say, well, the Premiership needs to pay much, much more down to what they call the grassroots sometimes, the pyramid the other times, then that's wrong. You know, we are in a world of unbundling. Keep coming back to this. We're in a world of unbundling where, sadly, business models are going to have to be devised to deal with the unbundled product. The market product fit of sport, if I can use venture capital terms, is out of focus. It's still talking about a bundled world. And I am pleading for sport, and I have been for 2 years, to say, can you work out your product market fit for an unbundled world of Hollywood clubs and community clubs? Because there is an answer. I know what the answer is. I wrote an article saying, where now for community clubs? You can do it. You need to be really good. It's not an easy business, but you can do it. So my fear is that the crisis and the answer to the crisis, which is under one big word, which is called political, becomes a deterrent and an obstacle to sport getting where it needs to be, which is fragmented, which is B2C, which is unbundled, and where everybody has to run a really tight ship and not overpay for player talent.
It's fascinating hearing you speak like that, Rog. And it's not that it's the first time. It feels like you're the sort of McNostradamus of the sports world. Is that you've been talking about it for a while? You didn't predict COVID. How could you? And yet, this was probably coming slowly. It's now seemed to be coming unbelievably fast because the wave is coming. In fact, the wave is apexing pretty soon and is going to be on the shore before anyone can say it. And one can keep talking about it, but it's about to land. And I wonder, there's going to be people like ourselves talking about it from the sidelines. But I do wonder how long it is before, you know, when do the clubs start to shut? I imagine it's imminent, isn't it?
It is imminent. They've delayed their liabilities and brought forward their cash. We said that a couple of episodes ago. They probably have got a couple of months in the EFL. But, you know, this just can't come at a worse time because there's no leadership, you know. And I said, probably in a huge minority, that Rick Parry might not have done it the way of elegance and respect of traditions that everybody likes in sport, but at least he had a fucking go. At least he had a go to try and come up with a plan. And, you know, all you see now is everybody coming up with Gary Neville and Bernstein and Greg Clark at the FA and some government minister. The way this will come out is that the Premiership will pay more money, the government will come up with some scheme, they'll get through it, and then, as I say, I hope we don't just come up with some kind of like government, state-run industry, which sadly seems to be the way most industries in the world will go these days. It's becoming more and more of a centrally controlled economy in the West. But there's a lot of good news out there. You know, I think there's if you embrace the change, I think you can benefit from it. The new audiences are going to bring new opportunities. I come back to the female audience. You know, I don't know whether you two saw this this week, but there was a couple of articles talking about female reporters in the media. And, you know, them explaining why, you know, they've always felt they were never given a fair crack of the whip. I think something on the BBC said, I didn't need to have a dick to be a good reporter on football, from one of the traditional female reporters. My view is this, again, it comes back to the segmented marketing thing. There's some people that are not necessarily sexist or misogynist or anything like that, but they want their football analysts to come from people who have been in that dressing room and know what goes on. That's legitimate. At the same time, there are new audiences, especially new female audiences, that don't want that. They want somebody like them to tell how they got in love with football or sport and how they too could do it. So I just keep coming back to the same thing. If you do your strategic marketing well and match up the audience needs with what you deliver, which is called product market fit, this will be fine. The problem is nobody is thinking like that. Everybody's thinking, how do we get through this and get back to where we were 1 year ago?
Roger, it seems to me that it's actually a lot more base than that. It's people are just thinking, how can we survive? I mean, whatever comes in the future to most seems like an afterthought to me. It's how do we stay in business? Which, look, if you're running one of these franchises, should absolutely be your first concern. I mean, that may be part of the problem is that too little time is being spent thinking about a different future, or even the same future. People are thinking about the present and how do we get to tomorrow. And it's difficult, I think, for a lot of people, even kind of seasoned business leaders in times like this, to be able to think past how do I pay the bills that are due on Friday.
And it's really interesting you say that, Grant, particularly as now I'm a groundsman sweeping this very fine square. And therefore being on the boundary ropes as well, looking in on the sports industry. But if I take an example of one of the businesses I'm involved with, our listeners know PumpJack, who are a data platform. The only question that one wants to talk to rights holders about if you're in that business is, do you know your own fan? Do you know your consumer? Which in any other business is a Janet or John question. You would start with that. Who is your customer? And the sports industry still resolutely says, well, they either bluster and say, well, we've done a few email things and we've done a bit of harvesting of emails. So is that data? Well, no, it isn't. That doesn't give you very much information at all, but it might be a bit GDPR client. And by the way, that wasn't the question, because everybody knows in business that to know your customer is a good thing. And that's as old as time. That's as old as commerce. To know how your customer behaves is absolutely essential for business. And sport still refuses, really. There's such an ostrich syndrome going on, and it actually
100%.
And that's exactly what Roger's talking about. If you believe that you've got to reproductize the industry to make it more appealing, because there are different sectors and strata of society who may like it, but just not in the old way, but they'd like it 100%. In a new way. The only way that you can then deliver that new product is to find out what people want. And the great joy is, and it goes back to what Roger's saying, is technology has allowed us to do that. It exists. It's available now. And yet people still say, no, I've become the CEO of a football or rugby or cricket or badminton establishment, whatever it may be. And the first thing I must do is I must get fitted out for my new blazer and make sure the crest is straight. And then I get the tie, and then I'm going to go to a couple of lunches, and then I'll start thinking about the business. I'm being really obtuse here. They're thinking about the wrong things. And the only thing to think about now, particularly we're in this hurricane of a disaster, is that the promised land is to understand the consumer, to understand your product and change it where it needs to be changed. And because of the binary nature of sport, of competition, which is hard-baked into the human condition anyway, which is we like to compete, we like to watch competition in the same way we like sex, in the same way we like music. These things are within us. If those are repurposed, the sports industry has a new future, which is a rosy one, but not if you keep going back to the same.
Giles, the potential market for fans wanting to pay to watch you have sex, I would imagine, is fairly limited.
It's what
fairly
limited. It's what you'd call a niche audience.
It would be, yes, a very eclectic audience.
But Grant, to take your point about survival, you know, we are absolutely in the vita mia morte tua moment for sure. Absolutely for sure. I noted down a couple of ones just from today's inbox. You know, you've got UCLA suing Under Armour for more than $200 million for breach of contract. It's not clear why. There's all the usual force majeure stuff in there. $200 million, that's a huge number. That's UCLA, yeah? It's a college. We mentioned when Jerry Cardinale was on, we said something like, and what if Media Pro get cold feet about your acquisition of Toulouse? They're now about to sue Media Pro, the league, because Media Pro ain't paying up. Our friends at PPTV, the Chinese Suning people who had the rights to the Premiership in China, they refused to pay. The Premiership took a very hard line with them, kicked them out, and I think they've put 10 cent in. You know, we are in a moment here now where it is, you know, dog eat dog. And as I say, this is the moment of crisis. I don't have a crystal ball about how that's going to work out. All I know is that when we get through this, I think we can do some really interesting things in sport. But in the meantime, there are going to be careers ended, companies crippled, broadcasters that don't make it. And then you're going to have some huge winners. One of the big winners is going to be Amazon. You know, you can see that, you know, they have got a very clear idea about sport. It's how it affects its core business of Prime subscriptions, you know, and they're bidding for Champions League in Italy now, and they've been very active in other areas. And, you know, even I think in one of the deals they did in American sport recently, they have again come up with a customized service where, not live, but that will come as well, but delayed, you can actually get some of the input that only the coaches see. And remember, we talked about the dressing room being the holy grail of the last thing you could sell broadcasters. Well, Amazon have got a little piece of that. Let me just see, because I wrote it down. Which company is it? Which rights holders have got that with? The NFL. It launched an interactive on-demand replay service for viewers through its X-ray tool during last week's Chicago Bears-Tampa Bay Buccaneers game. Data only previously available to coaches and broadcast crews is now accessible by Prime Video subscribers. You can see that. We joked about that the last time, that, you know, sport will become a subscription monkey for Black Friday type thing. There is a future. It's a future that's complex. It's a future that's a matrix management, strategic marketing to the hilt, with brand loyalty all over the place. it's going to be super exciting. It's not going to be for my generation, our generation, but for our kids, I think it's going to be a great time to be in the sport industry.
Let me ask you both a question. If I'm going to give you a blank sheet of paper and all the funding you need, what business would you set up right now? And in which part of sport? Giles, what would you want to establish right now, given those parameters?
Well, I guess I already am involved a little bit through a unified data platform, just getting the information of the customer owned by the sport, the rights holder, to make them more attractive to investors, make them more attractive to sponsors, make them more attractive to media. And particularly, I think, in the revenue generation, where if you understand the bogey of how much a fan is worth today, and it's empirical, it also allows you then to know what they're worth tomorrow. And then you're creating a business rather than hoping for the handouts of media and sponsors where you go to the begging bowl, hoping you can make an emotive case. So that would be one area. The other thing I'd be doing right now is really spending, investing time in the world that Roger actually comes from originally in terms of accounting, is really strong business practice in terms of risk appetite, investment, financial accountancy, to make sure that your business plan can work. I think the reason why private equity is piling into sport right now is not just distressed assets and there's value, but also because if you do your job properly with the right kind of accountancy, business practice and data analytics, so the two are very connected, you can actually start to predict income and revenue. And that for private equity is where you start to grow, because it's a known entity. At the moment, there's too much just put a finger in the wind and hope that money will come, because it always did come. And now it's not so certain. So that's probably what I do. Really boring answer. Otherwise, I'd probably buy the Exeter Chiefs or something, who I'm in love with at the moment. But maybe, because they won the European Championship. But no, that's how I would go.
I've got a macro answer and a micro answer. Macro answer, if I had the blank piece of paper and all the funding, I would create a global women's football league, done with the kind of strategic marketing I'm talking about. Very, bleeding edge technology, green screens based around personalities, really go for a market that's never really been touched by football, and maybe not sport, which is the female market. But do it properly, do it like a Refinery 29, really set out to be attractive to that market. I think you could create something globally that would be beyond anything in sport just now, a global league, female soccer stars based around celebrity and lifestyle. That would be the macro one. The micro one is the one I'm already involved in, and I'm hesitant because I don't like to do the publicity thing, but the biggest opportunity for sport is to capture and save the enormous cost of injuries. You saw Virgil van Dijk. Put a number on that, Grant. What is that overnight? 24?
Well, I mean, imagine what it'll cost Liverpool to go and buy a centre-back.
The wages, the lost performance.
And everybody knows how desperate they are to do it. So the price is doubled immediately, right? Yeah, you're right.
Right. So Kevin De Bruyne's out. The numbers that, we've looked at Zone 7, the numbers that you can save there are huge. And the technology works, if you look at the last injury that a club like Gaddafi has had, it was like almost 2 months ago. We've got some clubs that have come on recently and they're not having injuries anymore. So there, as they say, as a joke, there are other brands available, although in this case there isn't, but let's assume there are. there's nobody got the AI. That is where I think sport can really do itself a favour and say, we are no longer going to accept. This links into Giles' thing about risk management as well, and insurance and all of that. We are no longer going to accept the outrageous cost of injury when we're paying people 300 grand a week and it's costing us 100 million to buy them. We are no longer going to leave it in the hands of some of the people that we've seen in these documentaries, All or Nothing, that hang around treatment tables and you say, I'm putting 500 million of capex in the hands of these guys, and they've got no tools or very little tools. So that would be my second answer. And not just because I'm involved, it's because it is the biggest cost item in sport that you can realistically have a go at.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Well, look, chaps, we've just about run out of time. But before we close, we owe it to both ourselves and the listeners who are still waiting to hear why Giles is so enamoured with the Exeter Chiefs and to give him a chance to blow Nigel Owen's trumpet, if you, for want of a slightly better phrase. So why don't you tell us exactly what happened for us, for those of us that didn't see it?
Well, it was astonishing. It was a great final. And it was right to the end. And I think people should go and have a look online to have a look at it. But what Nigel Owens does is a decision has to be made at the moment at full time. And he questions the TMO about the timing between what was on the television clock and what was on his clock. And he forces them to listen to him so he can make the right decision. And the decision he made is binary to the result. And it's the way he handles it when people talk about technology and the referee and are they important right now, human judgment is used with technology in a way that only rugby could handle and only Nigel Owens could handle in the way he handles things. And I'm not going to spoil it. It's just, for me, one of the great bits of refereeing I have ever seen. Because, of course, with the technology and the microphone, it's right there for everybody to hear. And the roar that went up when what unfolded happened, it will live with me forever. It's just very special.
This is on video, is it?
You can look it up.
I'll post that.
It's funny, Charles. I've just typed in just so I remember to look at it after we finished recording. And I've got your glowing description of that in my ear. At the same time, I'm reading the first article that comes up, which says Nigel Owens embarking on his usual look at me performance in the European Cup final, having botched the key decision on the Exeter Cup.
I go with Giles.
No, as I suspect I will too. But it just shows you, right? Everything we love about sport is right there.
There are other people who are not going to be happy with the decision. What I like about Nigel Owens and always have done is he is brave. And he does what he believes is right. He is there to referee the match, and he does it his way. And I don't know. I remember when I learned my rugby. It was the rugby I was taught was by a Welsh rugby coach who went on to coach Wales, Kevin Bowring, and he taught it that way, which was the referee is right, and his decision is final, and you show respect because that's part and parcel of the game. And my God. That is a good lesson in life. And
it is.
It's really old school and boring, but...
No, it's not. It's the way it is.
It's the
Look
way
at the
it
mess
be.
That football is in now. You know, it truly is. It's got itself into such a fankle now. You know, the winning Liverpool goal substance says that's not offside. That's just not offside. Anybody that knows sport and certainly has played and knows football knows that Mane is not offside. Just isn't offside. The form is that his elbow is poking out a little bit and the goal's chalked off. A last-minute winner in a fucking Merseyside derby. People really need to have a look at themselves there. Is that what they intended? You know?
I'll tell you what, though, Rog. Thank God there weren't any fans there. Well, listen, gents, I think that's the perfect way to wrap up another sterling chat out in the middle. All that remains is to once again, as always, thank you, the listeners, for sticking with us. Otherwise, as I've said before, we'd just be three old men ranting at each other. So thanks for your support for the podcast. Please, if you haven't taken the time to rate and review us in the iTunes store, that would be enormously helpful to us. It really does help people find the podcast. We'll be back again next time. In the meantime, please follow us on Twitter. You'll find us at EntertainedR. That's the word A-R-E. You'll find me at TTMYGH.
You'll find me, Giles Morgan, at GilesMorgan71.
And you'll find myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Gentlemen, back to work we go. See you next time.
Cheers.
Take care. Bye.